It's 7 minutes past 11 and currently 14 degrees in the valley. Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to Stories of Change, the show that embraces life's transformations through the power of storytelling and music. We've got a great show lined up for you today on the subject of storytelling and music. We've got a very special guest, and he's really got some soulful melodies to show you and share with you this morning. And as well, we're going to talk about some of his heartfelt performances over the years that have really touched the hearts of many in the way that his genre does. So he's not just a musician, but also a storyteller. Our guest weaves tales of change, hope and resilience through his soul-stirring tunes. With a love for acoustic, electric blues and slide guitaring, he draws inspiration from iconic bands and artists, which we're going to get into shortly and talk about in a lot more depth, and he creates that sound that resonates deeply with all of our own human experiences. Welcome, Dave.
Hey, Kim. How are you doing?
I'm very...
That was an immense introduction. Now I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life trying harder.
This is good. No pressure. It's great to have you here today on Stories of Change and with Yarra Valley FM.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Your music really does touch the souls of people, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But first we're going to delve into your story a bit. So I'd love to know, when did your love affair with blues and slide guitar first ignite, and what sparked your passion for this kind of genre?
Well, it's all pretty organic, really. I'm one of five I've got four siblings, and so when my older sister and brother started playing guitar, of course I had to, because, you know, that was sort of, if they were doing it, I had to do it.
Yep.
and so we had an old Epiphone Hummingbird, I think it was, floating around the house. And so we started off just copying sort of pop tunes. Back then you had like Don McLean and, you know, Beatles and all that sort of stuff that was all coming out. And, yeah, so that's how I sort of got my fingers on a guitar, I suppose. Then I sort of graduated sort of up to electric guitar. I sort of grew up with a lot of the my preference was for the British rock, so bands like Zeppelin and Purple, and you know, there was, and American stuff too, but I was sort of into all of that, and so gradually I moved up and started to, at one point I realized that we were playing a lot of Eric Clapton music in our shows. And I thought, oh, well, why don't we just do a whole Eric Clapton show, just all Eric Clapton music? So we did that for about, in actual fact, it's still running as a British rock show, but, yeah.
Is that with your siblings? You were doing that show with your siblings? You're out on your own then?
Sort of, no. Yep. So, yes. So my sister sings, and also my daughter sings.
Yep.
And they were part of that band over a period of time too. But I realised that Clapton was actually playing a lot of old blues tunes, and so I started having a look at that, discovered Freddie King, and then it was like, okay, you know, game over. This is where the action is.
Yeah, this is good.
And so that got me interested and started...
What a great story. So you've picked a song for us, Someday After a While, which is an Eric Clapton song. So tell us about this song. What does this song mean to you?
Well, look, it's an old blues tune, but essentially this is sort of where the transition happened, because we were playing that song and then we worked out that it wasn't actually written by Clapton. Mm. He was an interpreter of the blues. Mm. And so we started looking back, and so then you find Freddie King's done it. A lot of people will have done a version of it.
Yep.
But and most of the time, because it goes way back beyond, you know, computers and records and stuff like that, nobody really knows who, you know, a lot of the time they don't know who wrote which one.
Yes.
And people, like, I've seen Bob Dylan credited for writing blues tunes, and it's like, no, he didn't write that, but he had a hit with it and somebody put his, you know, name on the sort of title.
Mm.
But anyway, so there's a lot of confusion about it. Sometimes you know who it was, sometimes you don't. But this was an awesome track, and as I said, that's when I sort of really started to turn back and look for sort of the late 50s, 60s, into the early 70s artists. Mm. And Eric Clapton actually picked up Freddie King, who was sort of at the nearing the end of his commercial sort of life at that point. Like, he'd been a big artist and everything, mm. but he was sort of on, you know, coming down off the peak, I guess. And Eric Clapton picked him up, and they toured for, I think it was nearly 2 years, they toured together. And so after I worked that out, I'm like, okay, so now we see where Clapton's sort of coming from, because he's, in all of his blues interpretation, he's sort of paying tribute to the people that he sort of worked with and studied and all that sort of stuff. Mm. And a lot of really specific styles you can find with guitar playing. There's certain sort of movements and positions that you can take all the way back to a single artist, mm. and everybody uses them nowadays. Mm. But probably don't realise that, you know, it's a T-Bone Walker riff, or it was, you know, this or that.
Mm. Yeah, it was a whole new word when I was preparing to talk to you today. I hadn't even really heard about slide guitaring or and the techniques that were involved. So it was like for me, a whole new world opening up, and my daughter has just picked up the guitar herself. So I love hearing these stories. This is very cool. So shall we listen to the song? This one's Eric Clapton, Someday After a While. Enjoy this one. Welcome back to the show. This is Stories of Change with Kim Harris, and I've got a very special guest in the studio today, Dave McFarlane, and we've been talking about his inspiration behind his career, his music career, and what that's meant to him. He was talking about how he plays even with his family, which is so awesome. So and that was a great song. Thanks for bringing that to the audience today. And we were just talking off while that song was playing about how music has this incredible ability to kind of shape our lives and evoke memories. And I thought you might like to share a specific moment from your childhood or your early years where the magic of music really started to influence your journey, not just as a person but as a musician as well.
It's the emotional impact of music can't really ever be underestimated. You know, it's a different language, it speaks to you in different ways. I think when if you're going through sort of tricky sort of mental spaces, and especially when you're younger, I guess I think the first thing that is helpful is to understand that you're not the only person to have ever done it, and there's probably plenty of people around you can talk to who would understand where you're at. Mm. So it's sort of being part of something rather than isolated, I think. And so music, it's that brings people together. Mm. And also you express things differently. I sort of tend to think of my songs as conversations, often to myself, even notes to myself. And yeah. Even now when I listen to songs I wrote, you know, 30 years ago or something, I sort of think, oh, yeah, I should remember that. Yeah. Whereas if you just had that written in a diary or something, I suppose you'd never even think to look at it.
Yeah.
But the ups and downs of life. Look, when you're a musician too, getting started is tough. Mm. I often sort of think that if I had to learn a new instrument now, I probably wouldn't, because I'd get discouraged. You know, when you start off with guitar, it's like, I'll be a rock star, this will be awesome. It's like, look, I've worked out a chord. And they go, you know, you're going to need more than one chord. It's like, don't care, this is awesome, I'm halfway there. So you're all, you've got plenty of energy and enthusiasm and you get into it.
Yeah.
But a lot of performers actually have issues coping with the ups and downs, because you perform to an audience, you want them to like it, you're bothered if they don't, because you think you did something wrong. Every time I perform, I sort of walk away and I've never ever thought, oh, that was great, you know, gee, what a good job. Yeah. Like, it's never like that. You walk away and you think, all right, I think we got away with that. but I really need to work on this or that.
Yeah.
And but having said that, recently, a couple of the shows I had, we reformatted them, and I started playing bass guitar, which I'm not a bass guitarist. And so I sort of had to learn, okay, it's a guitar, but bass guitar's a lot different to normal guitar. It's sort of funny, like I had to learn about 80 songs and a fair bit of technique and stuff to do it. And at a certain point, I realised that it actually probably expanded my brain. I'm like, it was sort of good for me to realise that I can still learn something.
New tricks.
And exactly right. Yeah. And so it was a bit sort of, and I think they're the moments that in music, that's sort of, they're the best ones, because you want personal bests rather than the audience to love you all the time.
Yeah.
Well, look, you know, everybody wants the audience to enjoy the show. That's sort of why you do them.
Yeah.
But if you're reliant on approval from people you don't even know to validate your sort of career or your skills or whatever, it's sort of probably not necessarily always a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess from my line of work, what you're talking about, when you do take on a new thing and learn a new skill, you actually do build brain density. And they believe when Einstein died, he had this really heavy brain, and it was not because he was super smart. It was just that he'd forced himself to continually learn so much that his neural networks were always getting really meaty, because he was just forming connections, and he did a lot of diverse things. He even played instruments weirdly too, and he did meditating, and he had all these little quirks about his personality, but he built that brain density over time by forcing himself to learn it. But I really love what you've just said about being intrinsically motivated, it's called, and that's when you're looking for an internal kick in what you do, and it's way more powerful way to live, because we can't always control the external, and we can't always control what people are going to think about us or what they're going to feel or anything like that. It's very, very powerful motivator.
The other thing too, if you sort of move into songwriting, then that's expressing yourself differently. You've got music, you've got sort of concepts, ideas, words, how it all fits together, than how you perform it. And the interesting thing was, I started writing songs, and the first song I ever wrote is still basically, a song that we use regularly in sort of original repertoire. But I got involved in a couple of songwriting competitions and did okay. And then I started to work in the folk festival circuit. And they said, oh, you've won some awards, you should do some songwriting workshops. And I sort of sit down and they say, oh, so how do you write a song? And I go, I actually not really sure, because one of the old blues guys, he was being interviewed, and they said, oh, how do you come up with all this great material? And he said, oh, I didn't write it. He said, I don't write these things. They're given to me. They're revealed to me.
Yeah.
And that's literally how it worked for me.
Yeah.
Like I'd sit down and have a bit of a scribble and go, oh, okay, so something in front of that and after it's going to be a song.
Yep.
And I wouldn't even have any idea what it was about. And then partway through the song you go, oh, okay, that's what it's about. Ooh. And then you'd sort of refine a little bit.
Yep.
But, so some songwriters, they'll take notes, take a notebook around, and they'll write ideas and keep them and stuff like that.
Yep.
And my approach was always sit down, have a crack at it. If it doesn't work out, screw it up and throw it away.
Yeah.
Because if it's a good idea, it should come back.
Yeah.
And so I always wrote like that.
Yep.
And then at one point I went to university to study music, because I'd never really formally studied anything, and I did a songwriting course. So they said, all right, we're going to do Nashville title first songwriting. I'm like, well, that sounds interesting, what do you do? And they're like, oh, you pick a title and then you expand that into a song, the title's going to be the first line of the chorus or the last line of whatever. And I had to actually do one properly, where you don't just whack stuff together and have it all work out.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. It was great to learn that there's other ways that stuff comes together.
Yeah.
Because again, if you use my approach, which was like, you know, wait until it's revealed to you. They're not revealed to you, well, you've got a problem.
I love it because I talk on my show a lot about the process of creativity, and there's like four stages of creativity, and you've perfectly described it. Like there is, it's called, like it's sort of where you build the skills, like so you're not like twiddling your thumbs and doing nothing. You actually do learn how to play a guitar or an instrument or whatever. People learn to paint or whatever their instrument of choice is. And then you kind of develop your skill set in that. And then there's this point where you just have to walk away and let it marinate and incubate kind of the skills, incubate the thoughts, incubate the feelings, and then you get this flash of inspiration, which might just be, you know, the header, the headline, or one line in the song, or one colour choice, or whatever it is, depending on the art. So it's really, we do wait for that kind of inspiration, but you also do need to have some skill to kind of back it up. And sometimes the skill, that's what sounds like happened to you. My takeaway was that you kind of went, you're using the same process, but just come arriving at it in a different order, perhaps.
So it's a bit like a footy team.
Yeah.
You put all the sort of stuff together and sometimes you've got a winning side, sometimes you don't.
Yeah, and sometimes you've got two great sides and who decides the who's going to win when they're both equally capable. And I think that's that outside force, outside forces at work sometimes that bring things together. But the last step, which is the part two that you just kind of touched on in what you're talking about in the performing of it, that's kind of the testing of the idea, and that's the final stage of creativity. It's when we actually go, okay, with all of my skill set and all of my ideas and my inspirations, I've created this thing, you know, and here it is. And then you're testing it on an audience, you're testing it, and by the sounds of it, some of these blues songs have been around for, you know, decades, like, you know, and and that's the cool thing about music, I think. Good songs just appear in every decade. Some people will be really like, oh, there's no good music in modern music, but there really is. There's some really good lyricists and there's some really good melodies that really do strike that chord, and that's the final part of the creative process when we actually, you know, give it to the world.
Well, the last song we heard, which was Cream, Crossroads. Crossroads was a Robert Johnson song.
Yes.
And he's sort of credited as the, you know, granddaddy of the blues.
Yeah.
And that sort of process of them taking old blues tunes and then sort of like turning him into something that an audience would respond to, because the blues, it comes and goes all the time, you know.
Yeah.
B.B. King said, like, playing the blues, he said, it's like being black twice. He said, you know,
what a funny thing to say.
You know, because they had segregation.
Yeah.
You know, they were ostracised. They could only play in certain places for being black.
Yeah.
And then if you played blues, it was like, oh, my God, why are you doing that as well?
Yeah.
And so it sort of comes and goes.
Yeah.
And Clapton, to his credit, has been fairly active in keeping it alive. His album From the Cradle was a ripper. He's done, you know, Robert Johnson, an whole album of Robert Johnson tunes as well.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff. But, it's, I don't know, I think, good music in any form, doesn't really matter what it is, whether it's blues or sort of, you know, a recent release, country, whatever.
Yeah.
If it speaks to you, well, it does, and that's
right. Well, we're going to play one of your songs now. So we are going to play Falling to Ground. So tell us a little bit about this one.
This was a song I wrote sort of fairly early in the piece too, and it's really just sort of talking about probably depression, the ups and downs of performance, as we discussed.
Yeah.
And as I said, I sort of start writing it and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I see what that means now. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, if people listen to it, they'll probably sort of get the general idea.
All right, let's play it. We are having an absolutely fabulous conversation here off the air. I wish we would live just then, because we're just talking about the power of music in bringing people together and these relational aspects of life that really are the most important things, and we'll get into that in a minute. But I've got another question for you. So aside from being a musician, you're also a storyteller through your lyrics, and we touched on that earlier. So is there a particular song that you've written that carries a profound personal story or experience, and could you share the inspiration behind that song?
So this the song I've got in mind, it's called Nothing Really Matters. It was off an album I did in 2007. And essentially, the full title was Nothing Really Matters Without You. And really, the sort of take-home message there is, you know, the most important thing in your life will probably always be relationships and people. And so you get all caught up in things and achievements and, you know, works, sort of whatever, but ultimately if you've really sort of got to choose, you don't want to ignore the relationships in your life, sort of, you know, family, friends, children, you know, workmates, whatever. But it's sort of like that's what makes people I don't know, happier, more balanced, all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And so this one was all about that.
Mm. Well, let's listen to it. It's, as you said, called Nothing Really Matters. So enjoy this one. You're listening to 99.1 Yarra Valley FM. My name is Kim Harris. This is Stories of Change. And this morning we've been talking with Dave McFarlane. And just before the promo there, we were listening to one of his songs, which is Nothing Really Matters, which was inspired from a story of his life. But we've also touched on today the ups and downs of the music industry and the roller coaster of that. He's talked about when you first delve into becoming a musician, how lots of people don't make the cut in the end. They give up before they've even got there. So let's talk a little bit about some of your adventures in the music industry and some of those highs and lows. So could you share some of these, I guess the emotional things that drove you to continue on with your music and get out there and perform and bring other artists into the valley?
Yeah, so around 2007, I got involved in the folk festival circuit, and I did that for about 10 years. Along the way, we sort of thought it would be a good idea to have a local festival ourselves. So we got together a group of people and put together our own, which we ran at the National Rhododendron Gardens, as it was then called. It all reminded me of when I was young. I sort of went to the Boronia High School gym and saw AC/DC. And when they say it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll, it's bloody true. And
that's something to think about.
Exactly. Yeah. But so anyway, with the festival stuff, it was long and hard. Mm-hmm. And you still see sort of a lot of festivals currently at the moment, you know, due to the post sort of pandemic sort of conditions and stuff, are all struggling. Mm-hmm. But so it's the music business, it's sort of tough. But one of the things that we came out of that is that we sort of liked a certain format of concerts, personally, to perform format. Mm. So we didn't want to be doing sort of like, 3-45 minute sort of sets to pub crowds and stuff like that all the time. Mm. We weren't that type of thing. We preferred people to be able to sit and listen and all that sort of thing. When you're a songwriter, you want sort of more of a concert-y sort of experience.
Mm.
So out of that whole sort of festival organisational experience, we came up with a sort of a small version, which was, we called it the Concert Lounge. It's more loungy in size.
Sounds
but
good.
But it's a concert experience.
Yeah,
So we generally do sort of 2 1-hour sets. We have table seating, meals available, So the whole idea there is that you can, it's a great environment for listening. So for an audience, I think it's sort of great. You have a dance floor too, so people can get up if they want. I no longer sort of enjoy, you know, spending 3 or 4 hours in the mosh pit at the corner hotel or something because, you know, my back gets sore. No, so you're sort of just looking for a smaller, more intimate sort of performance from good artists that's well presented. We always make sure that our production is good lighting and audio. Mm. And so we've built that over a period of time. We've been running concert lounges for, I don't know, over 10 years.
Wow.
And we started off at Burringer in Upway. We did a little bit at Upway RSL. We went to the Bronya RSL, then to the Croydon Bowling Club. And the way it worked is, you know, we'd be doing a show somewhere, people would come up and say, "This is awesome. Could you do one of these at our place?" And yeah. I'd go, "I don't know, let's chat."
Yeah.
And so we went to Croydon, and the same thing, we had I got a call from a lady who worked at Rochford, had come to one of our shows, and she said, "Would you be interested in having a chat to the team up here?" Which we did. And so that's how we started with the Rochford Concert Lounge as well. So we run that at Il Vigneto, that's the restaurant down near the lake.
Yeah.
So it's really good food, great wine. We've got a great stage sort of set up, views out across the lake, the best sunsets in any venue nearly in the world, I would say.
Yeah,
and it's awesome. Easy parking. Yeah. And so it's got everything that you really like. When you've sort of driven into Richmond and then or Abbotsford, gone around the block 15 times trying to get a park so you can get to your club, and by then you've already missed the first set.
Yeah.
You're like, "Oh, easy parking would be awesome."
Yeah.
So anyway, so the team out of Rochford, when we spoke about it, we said, "Look, you know, this is what we do. We sort of do classic rock for a probably mature age audience." Their sort of drive really was to include as many local artists as they could, and also to encourage younger artists.
Yeah.
So, in between sort of lockdowns and all that stuff, we were running for Friday nights with local artists, often a lot of original artists, songwriters, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And even now we have a lot of local artists coming in. We've got the Bowie Band JD Delves.
Yep.
And also he's got another show, which is The Music of Neil Young, which is a personal favourite. I love Neil Young.
Yeah.
And so bands like that are coming through. But next week, of course, we have Soul Sacrifice, which is the music of Santana. So anybody who's ever been a guitar head, you know, this is your idea of a good night out.
Yeah.
And all of the big tunes, it's a massive band.
Yeah.
They have two full percussionists. Like,
wow, that's so cool.
Percussionists sometimes have a conga and, you know, a couple of other things to bang. These guys are surrounded by a massive amount of, you know, interesting instruments. There's two of them. And so obviously it's a really, really strong show. They do all of the big hits, Smooth, Black Magic Woman, Evil Ways, all the way through most of his career.
So
it's an awesome one. And it's interesting, you go into a supermarket and you're walking around getting your shopping, and something will come on the in-house music, and you'll hear it and you go, "Ah, Clapton," because you recognise his guitar tone.
Yeah.
There's not that many of them, but Santana's another one, and so you'll hear Smooth start up and you go, "Oh, Santana."
Yeah.
You know, they've got such a distinctive style. Probably B.B. King as well,
yeah,
be another one. But so Soul Sacrifice, The Music of Santana, that's on this Saturday. And there's dinner and show tickets as well as general admission, all off the Rochford website, which is rochfordwines.com.au.
Excellent. I think you've just touched on why I used to love... I used to get home from school and I had this guy who used to have this... He actually built his own speakers. He was, like, really into the sound, and so that would reverberate, you know, like... and he'd built this amazing system, and I used to sit down on the carpet and put the record on and open the double record, and just because it used to have the lyrics on the inside, and just sit there, and you'd sit there and listen to the whole album. And I just used to, and it was almost like I was in a concert hall, and so as you said that, I could remember it like a bodily experience of like, wow, that's what I like. I really like that concert experience. If only someone was bringing me nice food and wine at the time, even though I was young, so probably not the wine. But
reminds me, we used to put on something like Dark Side of the Moon,
yeah.
And then you'd sort of like lie there and go to sleep. You wake up in the morning and you'd be hearing the clink. Clink, 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 clink.
That's right.
Because you went to sleep while before automation, you had to take the needle off yourself.
You had to. That's exactly right. It's not everyone knows that. I think the newer generations would not know what we're talking about.
No, look, it's one of the things too is nowadays with streaming and whatnot.
Mm.
People don't tend to listen to an album. They'll pick a track out of it, maybe two, something like that. They don't listen to the whole sort of thing.
Mm.
But if you actually pick an album, like with me and Santana, it was Caravanserai was my introduction to Santana.
Good.
And it starts off really quietly with a few crickets chirping and stuff.
Oh,
and then a double bass comes in and away it goes. And it's just absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
But the whole album is a sort of a story. They're constructed.
That's what I loved about it.
They have a motion. They have sort of a pace.
Yeah.
And so by the time you get to the last track, which wraps it all up, it's been an experience. And I think that's one less good thing about streaming. I reckon that you can still listen to an album.
So as an artist, do you write like that still? Like, are artists still writing an album with that kind of storytelling experience, do you reckon?
Look, I sort of was until probably a few years ago when we realised that
people
music consumers were not taking it that way.
Mm.
And so, when you had an album to construct, you would usually put your single sort of at number three or something like that.
Mm.
But nowadays, no, that's got to be one.
Number one.
Just put your best song first and make it snappy.
Yeah.
It's like no long intros, just sort of like one, two, three, song.
Yeah.
And so you do change. But of course, it also comes down to, as what we were discussing before, you're writing sort of for commercial sort of release, you're writing, personally, you just like to express that type of stuff.
Mm.
And so my attitude now, because I've written a lot of different styles over the years, I've done blues albums, and one of my favourite things, I realised that Led Zeppelin and that were knocking off old blues tunes and turning them into rock songs.
Yep.
And then I was sort of like, well, I'm going to do it the other way. I'm going to take rock songs and turn them into a blues treatment. And it was just a fun thing. I still like to think that I'm the first person to ever play a Deep Purple song at Port Fairy Folk Festival.
Yeah.
But, so nowadays when I put sort of stuff together, I do tend to think about it more a song at a time rather than an album for that reason.
Yeah, well, let's play a Santana song now as we come up onto the news. Are you right to stay on just past 11 and we'll wrap up after that? But enjoy this one, guys. This is Smooth. So let's get back to the discussion with Dave. So we've been talking about all kinds of things about how music can really help people through tough times, life's ups and downs, and also inspire us as well and connect us over, shared experiences, melodies, moods, music, wine, everything. It's got everything. So as you know, Stories of Change aims to inspire our listeners to embrace change in a positive way, because sometimes change is thrust upon us unexpectedly. Sometimes we want things to change and intentionally go after it. But what advice, Dave, would you give to someone who's currently navigating through a significant change and might be seeking some comfort and hope through music? What kind of music, songs have spoken to you in those times?
Look, it's a bit personal because a lot of it comes down to familiarity. So I listened to a lot of Steely Dan when I was first studying music, and particularly an album called Asia. And so now whenever I hear any of those tracks, instantly you just love it. But I also studied classical guitar for a while, and even though I don't sort of play those styles anymore, listening to Brock guitar is awesome too, very calming. Mm. You know, some people like sort of, you know, different sort of orchestral sort of music. It's, you know, there's Brazilian. We did a little trip down the peninsula yesterday with my daughter, and we were listening to Django Reinhardt, which is gypsy jazz all the way there and all the way back. And that's awesome too. Yeah. And so I think it's really just sort of filling up some spaces a little bit. You can't sort of control everything that's going on, but you can sort of just take a little bit of time to pay attention to your immediate surroundings. And so with performance, for example, I used to get really bad stage fright, like, you know, classically as good as it gets, stage fright, and, which was weird because you would go, you hate it, you really don't like it, why are you going back to do it again? It's like, oh, I don't know. but after a while, what I did is, I'm like, all right, look, you know, the first thing that happens is I get on stage and, you know, you're not sort of comfortable. So then I started to bring a carpet square. I'd put the carpet square down. My microphone stand, wherever they put it, I'd put it there. So it was coming this way. And I'd sort of like, I had my little square, like a
square of safety.
You know, meter and a half square.
Yeah.
And I set that up the way that I like it.
Yeah.
And very small thing, but it immediately made me more comfortable on stage because you think, oh, no, we're here, we know where everything is, you know.
Such a good tip.
it's sort of little things like that. And another thing too was when you're practicing, you sort of get in a studio or whatever and you stand around in a circle and you practice. That's all good. When you get on a stage, everybody's lined up. You can't see the drummer. You're facing forward to an audience.
Yeah.
And so there's your next problem. Because you stand up there and it's like, oh, everything's gone weird again. It's like, what's going on? I'm just doing a gig. It's like, yeah, no, but you practice a whole different way.
Yeah.
So you need to... So I call it flight formation. We practice in flight formation occasionally at least.
Yeah.
And again, you go onto the stage and you're like, all right, so... Yeah, I'm still nervous, whatever, but we've got a little patch of familiarity, and I think music assists with that too. And so you'll find that just having sort of something that you like and is familiar to you is it's sort of calming, reassuring.
I love that. I really love that. It makes me think of TED Talks. So people often feel very nervous about public speaking, and TED Talks, obviously the rage, and people get on the stage and they literally have like a red dot that you stand on when you give the speech.
All right.
And it makes me wonder, like, when people are practicing, if they're practicing on a red dot, so that they're having a similar sort of effect on themselves. Just this feels okay, I can do this, there's something familiar about this. But I'm glad you touched on the idea of stage fright, because I did wonder about that when I was thinking about you. I thought, because people can have a very loud inner critic as well, and I've talked about that on the show a few times, and how do you turn that dial down on that voice so that you can turn up, you know, more the calm that you're talking about, and not buying into that, you know, story that's really just in your head. And sometimes it stops people from getting out there.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I had real problems with it. And at a certain point, I just had a moment of clarity, and I realised that I'd done pretty much everything you can do to embarrass yourself in front of people at least once or twice. and it's like, so...
And you survived all of them.
I'm still here, and I'm still doing it. And so maybe I was overthinking a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's... you've got to get to that point. We deal with a lot of high-level experienced performers who... just really nervous, you know. They pace, they can't eat, they chuck up, they, like, you know, get cranky at everybody, and all that sort of stuff. And then sort of as soon as the show's over, they're sort of like a different person. And I get it, and you see it a lot. It's a tough one to sort of work out, but there are some things that you can do to sort of probably start to move it along, I think.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting, Dean, but I'm sure very reassuring, because like we're normalising things. I think you touched on it earlier when we're talking about, you know, there's people who we've all shared similar experiences, and there's actually more people like us than not like us. But sometimes we can feel like we're all alone and going through something alone and no one understands us. So I think it'd be tremendous for those performers to have you there to sort of go, yeah, well, just let them be, let them process what they've got to go through, to let them do their thing and take flight. I love the idea of the flight formation. I think I was telling you my logo for my company is a bird, and I have a lot of bird things, and I think about things like that. Like, how do you get the butterflies to fly in formation? How do you get the, you know? So I love the fact that you practice it and give yourself the best chance, you know, of getting out there and connecting with the audience, which is what it's all about, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, exactly true. And I think the other thing about the sort of like stage fright too is, you know, you sort of perceive it to be a weakness. You can't go up and say, people, I'm freaking out, you know. Because nobody wants to hear that, because, oh, you know, I'm a rock star. I'm a rock god. I'm like, watch cool. this. I'm about to hit the stage and entertain 1,000 people. Like, it's not like, and so the if you can actually sort of, have a look and go, all right, well, this is what's happening. What can we do to help? And the other thing too is that I have this switch in my head, and it's like I get a certain, well, it's like when you turn up at the gig or something, when you're loading in, it's about then it's like, oh, well, everything's too late now. If you thought you didn't know the material, too late. If you think it's going to go bad, also too late, because you can't do anything about it. If you think it's going to go good, don't get too cocky. So you sort of kind of that is another thing. If I know that I'm getting nervous about a show, I will actually get stuck into it really hard and really sit down and sort of spend as much time as I can to make sure I'm as good as I'm going to be in the available time. But at that point you go, and that's that. It's like, cut. We're sort of, now we just do the gig and see what happens.
I love that. And I think it's so important to normalise all this, because I think there actually is a series on Netflix at the moment. I think it's Dean Lewis. He's a fairly young, up-and-coming. He's got some really good songs. And they've done a bit of a Netflix special on him. And he has terribly debilitating stage fright. So he talks about it and the anxiety that it promotes in him, and he is one of the ones that vomits and you know, really gets quite unwell, like, and so the effect of that over, you know, a long gig, like where you're performing multiple shows over multiple months, really has taken its toll on him at times. And interesting series. So I think they're normalizing that just in general. In our world, I think we're seeing a lot more normalisation of our emotional experiences and the ways that things impact us sometimes.
Yeah, because stage fright, it's, you know, it's just another example of, you know, having a bit of a meltdown about stuff that you're not comfortable with, and it might be sort of work, it could be stuff. I remember years ago I was driving trucks, and Tuesdays was my city run. And every time I went in there in a reasonably large truck, I'd usually get stuck in the laneway somewhere, because you'd be driving down there, you get to a point where you just can't move, you can't go back, you can't go forward, and so you'd have to sit and wait. And so Tuesdays were sort of not my favourite day. I always get a bit antsy about those ones too, so it's all different things to different people. And talking about public speaking, you know, I really don't like it myself. I don't, you know, put me up in front of, you know, a crowd at a wedding or something,
person.
And I'm sort of like, oh,
because I have to.
I can talk about a lot of stuff, but I'm probably not so I'm not sort of so good at sort of articulating sort of feelings, and you'll get sort of people who'll get up there and sort of have a great sort of emotional sort of speech prepared, and it's like, I don't know, it's not really my thing. And it's like, oh, well, look, you know, sure, I could improve, but it's like, again, it's, well, everybody's different.
Yeah, and it's a different medium, right? So it's like, yeah, the spoken word versus musicians and music and lyrics, like you're still speaking to people through your music, and it's like it's a chosen medium, you know, and I think of it, doesn't really matter the art, you know, we're all seeking that connection with other, you know, the person that's, you know, witnessing or experiencing or feeling what we're putting out there. And yeah, it's just you've chosen your medium, which is music.
Yeah, and look, if you get one person comes up to you after a show and says, oh, that song you played, that was awesome, and it, you know, was exactly what happened to me or whatever.
Yeah.
You go, sweet, job done. You know, it's good. That's all it takes.
I know.
One connection is enough.
That's so cool, because I was going to ask that question, like, has a fan ever come up to you and said something like that, and what did it feel like?
And I've got I've got like one song that gets requested for weddings and stuff like that a lot of the time.
What song is that? Which one of your songs?
It's called Instead of Your Love. It's sort of, basically talks about sort of everything you could have instead of it, but you wouldn't.
Very good. Well, we were talking just at the start of this segment really about songs that have been a faithful companion in your life, and you mentioned Steely Dan, so we're going to play Steely Dan's Peg now. Enjoy this one. We are getting so stuck into a conversation while these things are playing. Dave was just telling me a story about a find in was it in the basement, did you say, or in the, under the house?
Under the house.
Yeah.
And so my grandfather was Scottish, and this was the chest they emigrated on with. It was all sort of under the house. It was all rusted and everything.
Yep.
But you could still make out parts of the shipping line and stuff. Just written by hand in paint on the sides. Anyway, it was had leather straps holding it together, mostly rotten, but I pulled enough of that out to make a hat band.
That's cool.
But I was thinking about the whole process of them coming over on a ship. And it's like a pretty big thing. You grab a box of everything that you can fit in, that's what you own, that's what you got. Whatever money you've got, probably not heaps, and you're just going to step off the wharf at the other end and see what happens. It's like, nobody would do it nowadays. You'd be sort of like,
I know two people have just recently done. They sold everything they had.
Really?
And they've just got one friend of mine, she's gone to Bali with a suitcase, and another guy, he's just driving around Australia at the moment. I did it when I was 18. I just backpacked around all of Australia, hiked everywhere extensively for a couple of years. So, you don't hear about it very often, but it was...
Well, you get a whole shipload of those coming in every couple of days, probably. But they would be motivated by moving away from the life that they've got, in my case, in Scotland with my grandfather. Anyway, so thinking about that and having worked sort of in the sort of folk music sort of thing, I've heard a lot of stories. There were guys who specialised in doing sea shanties and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so we knew the stories. And so I sort of thought, I'm going to just whack together a bit of a tune about that. And so that was called The Ships Across the Water.
Yep.
It was basically about emigrating... at around about the time of the gold rushes.
Yep.
And so you were still looking at sailing ships. It was faster, but I don't know the percentages, but a fair few of those ships never made it.
Yep.
They go a little bit too far to the right and they'd smack into an iceberg or they go a little bit too far to the left and they'd sort of get wrecked across the West Australian coast. It was navigation was less precise. But anyway, so that was sort of a family story, I guess.
Yeah, I love it. There's some lines in it. I know there was one. I think it's one of the lyrics is like stepping onto this new land, like I can't quite recall the lyric, but it was in my mind conjuring up exactly what you're talking about. Like, and I have a similar heritage probably to you, Irish and Scottish and English. And I know my dad and my mum have both been checking out our genetics and our family ancestry. It's very interesting. Because it wasn't that long ago, like, either. Like, it wasn't, you know, so it's quite astounding when you think of it. I think there's another Netflix show, I think it's 10 Pound Poms at the moment, which is a similar sort of thing. Like, people, you could come to Australia if you had 10 pound in your pocket. And,
And in my song, I refer to tossing a coin to go to Australia or California.
Yeah.
And that was the reality. Everybody knew there was gold in both those places. Which one? I don't know. Like, oh, there you go. Toss a coin. We'll see.
I love that.
Pick a ship.
I actually went for a drive recently. Actually, it was just after lockdown when we finally got the green light to go out and start roaming around. We got in the car and we found it. And an old coin, it was like all sticky. So it'd been sitting in the bottom of the car. And we thought, do we go? Where are we going to go? And we just tossed a coin left or right, and we ended up down the Great Ocean Road, actually, and it was a very, really interesting story there. But similar sort of thing, we were just letting the coin take us wherever because we were allowed to go somewhere finally, but we didn't know where to go either. So it was interesting. Yeah, wow, cool story. So I guess now we've gone carried away on the thing. Do you want to play the song? Shall we play Ships Across the Water?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's play it. We were just talking about the way that song makes us feel and just talking about music and how we just, get so wrapped up in it. We were wrapped up in it then. So the blues often dives into the depths of human emotions, including heartbreak and resilience. And listen to that one, that story of crossing the waters and starting a new life with nothing. Just amazing story of resilience, really, when you think about it. So how do you approach conveying these emotions? We talked about off air a second ago about when you're performing, like what emotions and thoughts go through your head and some of the challenges of that. Perhaps you could speak to that.
Look, once you've sort of written them and put them together, for me, I sort of tend to switch off when I'm performing a little bit just to focus on the actual mechanics of getting them done. Like, some of them are actually quite difficult to play live.
Yeah.
And that last song is sort of all finger-picking in dadgad tunings and stuff. And it gets, if you don't actually focus, you can easily just
get lost.
Stop playing the right stuff at the wrong time.
Yeah.
It's more about connecting. The one thing that we find with the concert lounge is it really is the connections. People, they tell us all the time, and when I'm not exaggerating, all the time, every week, multiple people will tell me that they love it because it's, as I said, it's a sort of a concerty experience.
Mm.
It's small, it's personalised. We know a lot of our customers, they come regularly. We have customers who even, book tickets on a spreadsheet. They hand it to me and say, can you book us in for all of those, please?
Yeah.
And, a lady yesterday was saying, look, it's a real highlight of our week to go to the shows. And I suppose when you think about it, it's social, it's recreational, it's a lot of things all sort of combined. But I think the other thing too is that, because our audience is, everybody who's there likes that show. So with Santana on Saturday at Rochford, everybody who's there is going to be a Santana fan. They haven't staggered into the front bar at the ESPY to see what's going on.
Yeah.
They're like-minded. And so you're there with a whole pile of people who are a bit like you.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so it's a great experience to sort of go out, and I think the connections are the important thing because I'm not sure whether we actually had the microphones on or off before when we were talking about connections.
Yeah.
But I think that it's the first thing you want to sort of try and maintain is, you know, connections with people and, yep. And it doesn't have to be sort of like, you know, participating in a team building exercise every week. It's just going out, seeing a few people, knowing a few familiar faces and look, I actually really appreciate it myself because we know a lot of our customers. But if I go to a bar in Abbotsford to see a band or something or other, you know, security will scan you on the way in, push you in the door. That's it. You're anonymous. Yeah. Nothing's personal. And then you're out again. Yeah. And I don't know. I just sort of like the old-fashioned sort of way of, you know, people knowing sort of where they're going, who they're with loosely and that type of thing.
Yeah, I think you've got it all there too. Like you make people like get a full belly as well, good food, good company, good music and shared that community aspect of the shared experience around, you know, a band that you all like or music that you all like or and I love that idea. And I talk about quite often in the show this idea of resilience and what it actually takes and even change. We actually can't change without the involvement of other people. And sometimes people think, oh, this person's never going to change. But actually, you can't change without other people helping you to change. And and it's such an important thing. And after coming through the pandemic and becoming quite isolated, a lot of people, they've gotten into that habit of being alone. And like we said, I think we were talking about that off air, like people just go down that rabbit hole of getting insular and just being stuck in their own mind. So to get people out in a safe environment where, you know, there's not going to be a whole bunch of drunk people around, they're not there to get, you know, plastered, they're there to listen to good music and enjoy good food and be together.
Well, at Rochford, probably a couple of months ago, there was a guy I was talking to and it was the first time he'd seen one of the concert lounges and he said, this is just amazing, this is awesome, like this place is absolutely beautiful, food's fantastic, the wines and everything is awesome and the music is like, you know, this is world class, you know. You've got a whole package here.
Yeah.
And sort of, and you know, as we're talking, then you sort of look out across the water and see the, you know, nice sunset sort of forming up. And you're like, this is good.
Not a bad. So then, what message do you hope your audience takes away from the music when they come to one of your shows?
Look, it's different things to different people, but I think the main thing is really just the social connection, sort of, you know, knowing that there's places that, you know, with like-minded people getting together and as sort of things change on in the entertainment change sort of and move on in the entertainment industry, I think that these have definitely got a sort of a good place with an audience who appreciates that sort of thing. I mean, look, you know, even 20 years ago it was, we openly discussed it, you know, we everybody knew that the music consumers were probably one of the worst, you know, treated consumers in the world, you know, herded in, sort of charged a fortune, facilities were shocking, everything was expensive, you know.
Yeah.
And but now it's all sort of getting different, you know. And you'll find even the large concerts at Rochford, you know, they're, you know, sure, it's busy, it's a big crowd and everything. But, you know, even the fact that they've got sort of like the big screens up and sort of plenty of facilities for people getting in and out is a bit sort of tricky in a regional area. But you know, it's definitely sort of a different type of an experience, concert experience than it sort of was, you know, if you compare it back to sort of the early days of big concerts.
It's kind of all about the experience now because people are getting a bit wiser, I suppose, with the whole, I don't know, we want to do better things for the environment. We don't just want to consume stuff and go along with the consumer story anymore. We want to start being citizens of the world and being much more mindful about our purchases and where we're buying things from and having these experiences, I think, are just, it's kind of the way the world is going. I think in general, we want to invest in those I guess it's all those intangible things that we've been talking about. It's not just, you know, buying something and putting it on the shelf. It's actually having a memory, you know, and connecting with people around that kind of shared experience is very memorable.
And I remember seeing somewhere there was a message that said, you know, buy experiences, don't buy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I like that. And I think we talked about off air just how in my show I really like to give the audience something actionable at the end of each show that they can sort of implement. And I know that after listening to your interview, our audience is going to be feeling very inspired and empowered to embrace life's changes positively through music, and finding that solace and strength sometimes through a perfect melody or lyric. So, and I love the stories that you've told us as well, and even you've talked about even the skills of being a musician, and it takes hard work and discipline and, you know, focus and all of these things that, you know, are so important in the topic of resilience that I often talk about. So thank you so much for sharing your story today. That's been really cool. And I hope that, you know, I was thinking we were talking about what might be an actionable thing that people could take at the end of listening to the show today. So what would you
I think
recommend?
Just sort of, you know, from a musical point of view, just really include it in your lifestyle, you know, set it up so that you've got, you can easily be sort of whacking on a disc or sort of whatever, you run it off your computer or whatever, just sort of get it so that you can hit a button and have a bit of music happening. I put stuff onto my phone and stream it to a Bluetooth speaker, and every night when I cook dinner I have a look at it and I'll pick stuff and then sort of listen to it, and yeah, and it's very reassuring, you know. I sort of have a T-bone Walker sort of list of old stuff. And every time I put it on, it reminds me of the scene in The Blues Brothers where they get to the hotel room and start cooking some toast and he's got a blues record sort of playing just before they get mortared. But it's that type of thing. It's sort of like, it just brings you sort of into a nice space.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what's happened.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about music, I think.
Yeah, me too. We always have music on. I talked about my kids, and we have the music on every night. And I find it interesting because I've got 8 kids, so they're very different, and they all have their own unique music styles. But I think you're absolutely right. The more that you can include it as a way of life, and music as a way of life and in your life, and I've got a home speaker, so I can just say, hey, play this song whenever I, you know, whenever the mood takes me. And I quite often wake up with songs in my head. I have a constant soundtrack in my head. And so sometimes when I first wake up in the morning, I'll just say, hey, you know, play this song, because I've got to kind of get it out of my head. So I really like that idea. I think that's a very good actionable step for the audience to take. So where can people find out about you a bit more? Like, I know you said you've got a bit of a website in construction, if you like, but
we're sort of, with all the digital platforms and stuff like that, we always used to, you know, have CDs available and that type of thing, but now we're sort of shifting everything over sort of into a more modern format, just in construction at the moment. But it's just davemcfarlane.com, and if you hit that, it'll find the most of what's going on.
Yeah, and some of your musical ventures at Rochford and the Croydon Lounge as well.
Yeah, we have several bands that sort of that roll out shows.
Yeah,
and but the other thing too is that if you go to the Rochford website, they'll have all the shows listed, and we run our bands through there as well.
Yep, that's right.
I think the next one coming up is the Boom Babies. It's the 60s story in rock, pop and soul.
Sounds good.
We have another one called From Memphis With Love, which is all of the early Memphis pioneers, so Elvis through to Aretha, but all the soul stuff and that as well.
Wow.
And it's yeah, it's awesome. Actually, as we were, as I was on my way here, I sort of heard you announcing that I was going to be on the show, and I felt like going, hold on, I'm coming, hold on.
I love it. That is good. Because I was starting to think, oh, is he lost? I must have picked up on your vibe through the ether. But thank you so much. My great much gratitude to you for being here today. I think your music and your words would have really touched people today, and thanks for sharing all your insights as well for upcoming artists in the Valley. And I love the fact that we've connected, because I think we're going to be able to bring some of these young local artists into the studio, which we were talking about when you first arrived. And I know Frank, one of your colleagues at work, has got a few ideas about running a local talent quest and getting people together around musics and local musicians. So got some lovely things coming up on the agenda, I think, and some I'm glad that we've met. So thanks very much.
Nice to meet you, and thanks for having me on the show.
Appreciated. Excellent. Well, I'm going to play another one of your songs now, just to sort of bring it home nice and strong. This one's called Instead of Your Love. Do you want to say a few words about this song?
Yeah, so look, it's another one that's sort of just, you know, it's another message to myself. Remember, people are important. People are the most important thing. And so we put this one together. The harmonies are from my daughter and my sister, Barb McFarlane, who runs choirs across in the Dandenongs. And Elizabeth is from Miss Lizzie and the Night Owls. And but anyway, we put this one together, and it was immediately popular as a wedding song. You'll probably see why.
Okay, let's listen. Was Dave McFarlane with Jumping Jack Flash. For those of you who wish to experience the magic of Dave's performances firsthand, be sure to check out his upcoming shows and those musical ventures. He's got some fantastic acts coming to the Valley. You can find out more information and updates about those performances at the Rochford Concert Lounge website. And now, as I conclude the show, I just want to thank you, dear listeners, for joining us today through Stories of Change. Your presence and support make this experience truly special. Remember, you have the strength to rise above any challenge and create a life filled with purpose, joy, and resilience. So join us next episode as we continue exploring these themes of resilience and music and stories of change. Until then, take care of yourselves and each other, and I will see you next Monday at between 10 and 1. Yeah, let's get you in the mood for some more soulful tunes with this one, Dave McFarlane's Let the Good Times Roll. People talking, but they just don't.